The race is on, and the Mercedes dominance was shattered by that man, Max Verstappen, who claimed a stunning victory for Red Bull. Meanwhile, just as at Silverstone last year, Valtteri Bottas was left scratching his head over strategy after turning pole position into P3 behind teammate Lewis Hamilton. I'm Ed Straw, and joining me to look back on F1's terribly named 70th anniversary Grand Prix are Mark Hughes and Scott Mitchell. Mark, are you in the anniversary spirit? Do you think that was a fitting landmark for F1?
I think it was quite funny that it was the 70th birthday of Formula One, effectively, of the Formula One World Championship. And it ended up as a fight, didn't it, on all the racing point stuff. A sort of fight broke out at a 70th birthday party. That's quite funny in itself, I think. But it was an entertaining race. It was a good weekend at racing, I think. And there was lots to talk about. The one-step softer tyres, certainly in combination with the increased pressures and the very hot track temperature, certainly produced a few curveballs, and that was behind, I think, the upset we saw in the race result.
Yeah, that's what we like to see, a bit of an upset and some curveballs. Scott Mitchell, as always, calling in from Stockholm. How was it from there? Did you get your telescope out and manage to see Silverstone this time round or not?
We're not going to go into that again. I was abused enough the last time we went down that path. No, I thought it was good. Today I watched it through a normal normal screen like everybody else. Didn't try anything fancy. I think F1's looking pretty good for 70, isn't it? Doesn't look a day over 60. Pretty good race.
Well, that's certainly the case. It's probably the most interesting race of the season. So let's get into it. I mean, Mark, you mentioned a few of the factors, but this race was all about tyres. Max Verstappen started fourth, picked off Nico Hülkenberg, of whom more later, at the start, then ran long in the first stint on hard tyres. And what followed was actually a genuine surprise, as the Red Bull team didn't just out-strategy Mercedes, but actually had stronger race pace given the limitation of the tyres. So how and why has Verstappen suddenly been able to beat both Mercedes drivers in a straight fight?
It was a little bit... The Red Bull was working much better today than at any other point and during this weekend or any previous weekend this year. But more than that, it was the fact that the Mercs were in desperate trouble with blistering of the rear tyres. And it was there from very, very early, lap three or something, they knew they were in problems. And you'll have heard the radio where Max's pit wall was saying, your tyre temperatures are getting a bit high. You need to start backing off now. And he responded with, absolutely no way. This is my chance to race them. And what the pit wall couldn't know is what he was seeing was that when he was pushing Lewis and Lewis was, going through some of the faster corners flat out, Max could see that that line was forming on the left rear of Lewis's car, so he knew it had blisters, and he knew this wasn't the time to be backing away from them. This was the time to be pushing up to them, especially as he was on that harder tyre. So it didn't really matter too much if he was taking that tyre in a little bit past its optimum temperature, because his only competition was the Mercedes, and they were in much worse position. So that was basically the foundation of his victory. It was a performance victory, and it was because of the Mercs was such terrible tyre troubles, but Max and Red Bull took full advantage of that ruthlessly.
I thought it was amazing that Verstappen in that situation. I liked the way he sort of used his newfound sort of cockiness and humour over the radio to dismiss GP when he said, I'm not just going to sit here like a grandma, I'm actually going to go for it. But I find stunning with Verstappen is that he has that feel and understanding of the situation so early on in a stint to be able to say, no, I think I can push, because at that point you're just reading what the tyres are telling you, but he's also applying a bit of a little bit of clairvoyance to it, and he actually thinks, you know, if I know what it's doing now, I reckon I can carry on pushing this much without hurting them. And I just thought it was a masterclass in management from Max. I thought it was absolutely excellent.
Yeah, we see this from great drivers, don't we? We asked this question on the website. Does this mean that that Verstappen is the best driver in Formula One, which had a divisive set of opinions from all of us on therace.com. You can find that there. But I love it when drivers do that. They sort of take control of the situation. We've seen Fernando Alonso do that in the past. Fuji 08's one that always springs to mind for me, when he was running second behind Kubica in the first stint, but he was basically calling the shots.
Yeah, I think it's brilliant, because you've got a situation there where Mercedes found themselves in a rare set of circumstances that were really hurting them. So it wasn't just the fact that Mercedes was having a little bit of a bad day. I think they sort of saw themselves as being on the absolute worst end of the spectrum for problems with the tyres. But worse than that was the fact that Red Bull seemed to be at the complete other end of the spectrum, actually being able to manage it really well, to the point where I think they were having to do more management Mercedes in the high-speed corners while going slower than the Red Bulls. So that was really difficult, but it takes an excellent, excellent performance to be able to be there and punish them the way Verstappen did. So it's not just a case of, oh, Mercedes tripped up Verstappen and Red Bull. Like the circumstances just made them absolutely come alive.
Yeah, we've seen this ghost of this Mercedes problem in the heat already this year. We saw it in Friday practice in Austria 2. We saw it last week in Friday practice at Silverstone. They do seem to struggle with the tyres when the track temperatures get really hot. And this, of course, was made even worse with the high pressures and the particularly high track temperatures today. So this is the first time we've seen that situation carried through to a race day. And I think even Merck were surprised by just how bad it was. It didn't catch them completely by surprise. They were anxious about it going into the race because, as I say, they'd seen this ghost of this problem before, but I don't think even they were expecting it to happen, as fall apart the way it did so early.
Yeah, very much so. And after the race, Lewis Hamilton said that, you know, normally he's at the good end of the tyre management spectrum, but he was struggling with the way things were working. So I think it came as a real, real surprise to them.
Well, you know, it's bad because they're already talking about sort of getting, they're already talking about concerned about looking silly on Sunday in Barcelona, because in Spain this coming week, the temperatures are going to be very high again. We know that Barcelona is a very high energy circuit. So Mercedes, you know, Toto Wolff, Andrew Shovelin, they've both come out and said that they've only got a small window now to dig into this, because it's not enough. You know, Mercedes hasn't won the titles that it's won by simply shrugging and going, oh, well, you know, we suck a bit in hot conditions. We just have to take our lumps. That's not how they work. It's all about diving in and trying to find a solution. But they've not got long to do that. So there is a bit of urgency about Mercedes trying to get on top of this, because as Mark said, there were already a little bit of evidence to suggest that they're weak in hot conditions, but nothing to suggest it was this extreme or that Red Bull would come alive as a result of it. So it's a double whammy for Mercedes, and they need to get to the bottom of it.
Yeah, that's the thing. Problem known about, but the extent of it was just much more exaggerated than suspected. Now, Scott, Valtteri Bottas wasn't really very happy with his strategy. Just as in the British Grand Prix at Silverstone in 2019, he started on pole, but found himself beaten by Hamilton, who had a different strategic approach. Hamilton one stopped, Bottas two stopped. He wasn't very happy. Bottas didn't seem particularly happy today either. Do you think he has a point, given he was left out? Given Hamilton stayed out much longer in that penultimate stint, and then was able to come by him at the end?
Yeah, I can see how, especially in the moment, it must have felt like a proper stitch up. Not necessarily because Mercedes were genuinely trying to screw Bottas over, but just a big error, and then they then just tried to help Lewis. So I think it probably felt a lot worse than it was. And you know, Wolff was asked about this after the race and said he'd spoken to Valtteri, and because Valtteri, I think, had accused Mercedes of sleeping, basically bringing him in at the same time as Verstappen and basically locking him into a strategy in which he was never going to win. But then Lewis was given the opportunity to extend the stint as far as possible and maybe even consider the one stop. And that is ultimately what swung the race towards Lewis in the battle of the Mercedes. So Bottas felt very, very hard done by. But I think it's a little bit of... It seemed to me like Mercedes felt that they didn't really have any other choice. Hamilton was probably going to follow Bottas into the pits pretty soon. But then when they checked Bottas's tyres, they realised that beyond the blistering, there was quite a bit of rubber left. So actually, there was the opportunity to go longer with Lewis. But in all matters strategy, I tend to defer to Mark, because he's far more across these issues than I am.
In this particular case, it was, again, like last year, As you say, Scott, it wasn't the team trying to stitch one driver up for the advantage of the other one. But it was based upon Lewis doing a better job with combining the pace with the tyres. And the reason they brought Bottas in when they did was he had a pretty severe vibration. And given that was the prelude last week to the deflations, obviously they were a little bit nervous. They had Leclerc just, he wasn't quite within their window yet. So if he needed, but if Bottas had needed to back off a lot more, he might have started edging into his window. They weren't going to beat Max. There's no way they were going to beat Max. He was doing purples as he came in that were nowhere near what Valtteri could do at that stage with the tyres, the state they were in. But Lewis at that time wasn't complaining of a vibration. He had no vibrations at all at that point. So they just let him stay out there, especially, as you say, Scott, because they checked the tread depth on the tyres that came off Valtteri's car. So they were a bit more reassured by that, the safety of that, and so they just left him out there as long as they could until Lewis eventually started getting vibrations as well. But that was 10 laps later. So that was the reason he had that more strategic flexibility, because he hadn't quite taken as much out of the tyres, and that's exactly how he was able to do it last year as well, from behind.
There was a point, wasn't there, where Max looked like he was almost able to toy with the Mercedes. It was basically, keep your tyres in reserve just in case we need this pace. And it felt like Max had basically every option open to him once he'd extended that opening stint. I thought it was really, really telling that when the Mercs came in and Max still had that pace on his old hards compared to what they were having to do in conservation mode, that for me, as soon as that happened, it was like, okay, this is Max's race to lose.
In hindsight, when you trace it all back, you know, when you work backwards from the end result and see how it was achieved, all the signs were there by lap 7, lap 8, and it was just a much quicker car on those tyres on that day. And you don't get away with giving Max Verstappen an advantage and expect to come out on top, because you won't.
Yeah, a driver like that will always ruthlessly press home his advantage, and he did that brilliantly. But Mark, Verstappen's now only 30 points behind Lewis Hamilton in the Drivers' Championship. I say only 30, it's still quite a lot. Bottas is, I think, 4 points further behind. Do we now have to start thinking Verstappen could be a championship threat, or is that rather overstating it given the unusual situations with the tyres this weekend?
We were here not very long ago saying, can we see Mercedes doing a clean sweep? And we were saying last week that they probably got away with their Monza 88 moment, and it shows that it's not real any point in trying to predict these things, because it's when you're involving something as complex as Formula One and as unpredictable as tyres and weather combinations, there's no telling. But you know, if we get a similarly hot Barcelona, although the tyre choice is not as aggressive there, if we get a similarly hot Mugello, which is going to be very, very tough on the tyres, who knows? You don't know, but the underlying raw performance of the car in normal conditions, Red Bull's still quite a way behind, as they admitted post race today. It was just in these conditions on this day, they were much the better car.
Yeah, Christian Horner suggested that some of the car's more uncooperative characteristics have been got on top of, but there's still, particularly in qualifying, a deficit to turn over. So yeah, great for Red Bull. Mega win, good for the season, but it'd be premature to be waving Red Bull flags and thinking they're suddenly going to be winning the championship from Spain onwards, but it certainly made it interesting. Now, Scott, let's talk about a team that's nothing to do with the championship fight, and that's Ferrari. Everybody appeared to have caught up with its lower downforce approach last week. We didn't expect Charles Leclerc to repeat last weekend's race result after he qualified 8th. But somehow he kind of effectively did by finishing 4th, because of course last week he'd have been 4th without Bottas's late puncture. He managed to pull off a one stopper that nobody really thought was possible. So how?
Well, the team doesn't know, and Leclerc doesn't know. So I've got no chance of telling you why. Leclerc was really, really surprised. Even by the time the adrenaline had long worn off, and he was sitting down for Ferrari's Sunday evening media activity. He was saying, just don't know the reason, need to dive into the data, because I think it was after, was it after Friday, or maybe it was after qualifying, he'd said, you know, we really expect to struggle, because the pace hadn't been great in Friday practice, and they weren't, you know, at the top of the midfield group in qualifying either. And then, I don't know, it just seemed that all of a sudden the pace that they couldn't unlock in terms of the longevity of the tyres, but also managing them while running quickly, was suddenly there. So I suspect they'll be diving massively into the data to work out if this was an anomaly because of the raised tyre pressures, if it was some kind of combination of track conditions and track temperature and ambient temperature that just meant that they got them into a nice window. But there was a point where Leclerc genuinely thought he could snipe for third. I think he said it was when the guys came out of the pits, because when Verstappen and Bottas stopped, and Leclerc was like, well, hang on a second, I'm not, he's not dropping me. So he said he started to push, and then he started to feel a vibration of his own. So he sort of reined it in a little bit. But I think he was still, 10 seconds clear of the next car. So I think I said on the podcast last week, this was the British Grand Prix was Leclerc's best drive since Monza last year. But I think this is his best drive of the season and best result of the season, because corrected for, you know, anomalies and weirdness during the races, I think this is his best result, and earned from a really, really diligent and excellent performance. So I think he keeps finding new ways to one-up himself.
Yeah, his tyres were in great shape as well. You could see that even though he'd been on them for 30-odd laps, even as the Merck's tyres, which had only gone on sort of 10 laps earlier, in the case of Lewis, a bit more in the case of Valtteri, they were in pieces. And the Ferrari's just looking after the tyres beautifully. And I think there's got to be some sort of correlation with this relative lack of downforce of the car. It's relative lack of power. And the fact that it's looking after its tyres, I think it was probably these two Silverstones have probably been a really happy confluence of circumstance. I don't think there's anything really. I don't think they came here thinking we'll be on top of the tyres here if we do this. I think they came here thinking we haven't got very much power, so we need to run low downforce, and the circuit now rewards that quite well. Everything came together in Ferrari's favour of these two Silverstone weekends, and Leclerc's just like Verstappen. You give him something, and he'll just grab all of it and make absolute maximum use of it. He's just that class of driver. So he's done those two beautiful Silverstone drives. He did a beautiful drive in Austria to take the official second. You know, massively flattering the car at the moment, although the car is better in race trim than it qualifies. There's an element of that, but there is a very big element of him flattering the car.
It was, as you said, Mark, a happy confluence of circumstances, but only for one of the Ferraris. Obviously, Seb would massively disagree with the assessment, but I think you conspiracy theorists will have... We'll be watching back the first lap, the replay of Seb on lap one, and they'll be pinpointing the moment where Ferrari pressed the self-destruct button on Vettel's car into turn one. Because that was... And we've got quite a big catalogue of Vettel errors now over the last 2.5 seasons. I think that's the most unusual spin he's done. It was a really weird tank slapper, and it was only he only avoided total catastrophe because Carlos Sainz Jr. has ridiculous reactions.
It looked as though he had quite a lot of steering lock on, had put the car a long way over that inside curb, maybe distracted by, you know, wanting to avoid what looked like potential trouble because Leclerc had locked up, and had just overestimated how much grip there was on that curb and had the power on, and you could hear from the in-car, you could hear the wheels suddenly spool up very, very suddenly. And he basically just, power slid himself into a tank slab.
Yeah, another very, very tough weekend for Vettel. Although I would argue, it, in terms of pace, it was a lot better than last weekend, because at least he was, 0.369 off in qualifying. So compared to 9 a second last time, that was a step forward. But yeah, really, really tough weekend for Vettel. A lot of people have been writing him off, but to be fair, he's not been like this all season. I know we're only 5 races in, so interesting to see what happens when we get to Spain, a circuit that he should be a little bit happier at. But it's been a very, very difficult season, and a bit fractious as well in the car, wasn't he?
Yeah, I asked Seb if this is an unusual period of his career in terms of not being able to identify the problem and actually be able to improve, because he said this evening that he basically hasn't improved in the car since Saturday last week. So, and by that I mean Saturday at the British Grand Prix. So he's had, what was that, 5 days of running on track and hasn't been able to make gains. But he's pretty adamant that Austria you can't count, and Hungary was pretty good. So he's trying to view it from the point of view that it's only really at Silverstone. I think that's a bit of a generous interpretation on his part, because he has by and large been off of Leclerc, and especially when the car seems capable of its good days. It's now got to the point where, you know, you can see he's properly at odds with his team. There was the moment in the British Grand Prix after the flag where obviously he ignored Binotto coming over the radio. And then during the race today, he made a point, having spun on lap one and ruined his race halfway through the Grand Prix, he's pointedly telling the team, you've messed up, because they've damaged a strategy that's making the difference between him probably finishing 11th and finishing 12th or 13th instead. Like, he's pointing fingers. The team's not happy with him. It just feels like the relationship's just getting ever more fractured.
Yeah, it's not a good look, is it? And ultimately, when we had this discussion during the race, it's kind of, strategy, that's not your first order problem. Your problem is you pointed the wrong direction at turn one on the first lap. But yeah, I mean, Vettel, Hungaroring, he was quick. Did a decent enough job in the Styrian Grand Prix before he was taken out. So it's not utterly irredeemable. But yeah, in terms of the wider picture, it's not turning into a happy swan song. And I thought it'd go a lot better, actually. Let's have a look, Mark, at Alex Albon. He had another action-packed weekend. He struggled as usual against Verstappen in qualifying. He was about half a second off in Q3, although he was a little bit closer, actually, when they were both on mediums on that first run. He ended up on this odd strategy because he had the really early pit stop at the end of lap six, quite an attacking move. And then, sure enough, come the end of the race, there he is in fifth place, as Sundays again proved to be his strong suit.
Yeah, he's still struggling a little bit in qualifying. And he was a bit thrown by the balance change of the cars when he went from the medium to the soft tire in Q3. In fact, he was slower on a set of new softs than he'd been on a set of used mediums. So clearly something not working there. The more it happens, the more it's becoming an issue. And it sort of seems to be feeding on itself, and he's not getting these clear runs through the weekend. But then he does put these great recovery drives in, and he doesn't shy away from the big moves. I mean, that move he did on Kimi was one of the bravest I've ever seen. I think he found himself out there a little bit by accident, having figured that Kimi would give him a bit more room than that. But he stuck with it and then pulled it off. And he, it's a much faster car against a slower car, but you still have to pull the moves off. And he is very, very good at that. And he was flying in the late stages of the race and setting fastest laps. So, yeah, there is something in there, but he's not accessing it on demand. And it's going to, if the car becomes more competitive, hopefully that can just get him across that threshold and the confidence will start to come. But there were times this weekend where he looked very sort of down and as though he was struggling to come up with answers.
I do wonder if in qualifying trim, he does seem to struggle a little bit getting the tyres in the window. And we've seen this in various conditions. Like, he struggled on the warm-up lap last weekend to get the tyres up to temperature. And maybe with the softs, he went a little bit too aggressive because he struggled to, more on the softs than on the mediums in Q3. So I wonder if it's one of those things that you know, if you really get on top of the tyres, then you can flick a switch and there can be a bit of a step change. I don't think that suddenly means he'll be matching Verstappen blow for blow, but it just feels just that almost that inconsistency in the qualifying scenario makes me wonder if it's just not quite getting it right. There's always some one end or the other just seems to go, or because it's a really fine art doing that. But you know, that's just one of the many things. He's also, of course, up against an insanely quick driver in Max Verstappen. But fifth place, a good salvage job. Now, Scott, we haven't talked about Racing Point properly yet. We'll talk about the off-track business later on. Obviously, on the eve of the Grand Prix weekend, Sergio Perez again tested positive for COVID-19. Perhaps not a surprise, but they were hanging on for him. Nico Hülkenberg was back. So how impressed were you with that third place he got in qualifying?
Yeah, I thought it was excellent. Not so much because it's not where the car should be, because we know that the Racing Point is really quick. But I thought it was just a fantastic job that it was Hulk that was the guy who put it on third and not the team's regular driver. You know, he comfortably outclassed Lance Stroll in qualifying. And I'd wager as well, he actually did a better job than Lance in the Grand Prix by virtue of his better track position. And it was only, I think, because of... I think he had a problem, didn't he, late on with a vibration, so pitted towards the end. But the qualifying was the most impressive because it's the fine details, the nuances that unlock those last sort of one or two tenths of pace. And I think in general the expectation was if he could get within a couple of tenths of Stroll, you know, who isn't a terrible driver, then Hulk was probably doing a really good job because he's been out of the car since Abu Dhabi last year. He hasn't been living and training like a Formula One driver. And this is a team that he's relearning as well. He's been with Renault for what was it, the last 3 years in Formula One. So he doesn't have all the tools at his disposal. And Lewis Hamilton said last weekend at the British Grand Prix, he can't even begin to say how far Nico is behind all the other drivers because he's not in tune with all of the tools that he's got at his disposal. So it was never really expected that Nico was going to be absolutely mega in qualifying. And yet there we were, Saturday afternoon, he's pumped in. He's just about got through to Q3 because he thought he'd made a massive error, damaged the car in I think his first Q2 run. And then he pulls out the bag. Absolutely stunning lap. And yeah, absolutely one of the stars of the weekend.
And that got him an almost unique experience, because I think obviously this is not what the word unique means, but I think that's only the second time in his career after qualifying that he's been in one of the official top three post-qualifying or post-race press conferences, the other being his pole at Interlagos in 2010. So it's been a while. But yeah, it was interesting in the race because, yeah, Hülkenberg, I was a bit worried for him at the start, but he only lost one place to Verstappen, and then he was always going to fall behind Verstappen. So that counted as a win, and then he was running ahead of Stroll because Stroll got ahead of Ricciardo, so they were fourth and fifth, and then obviously Leclerc and Albon got through them. Obviously there was some suspicion and raised eyebrows about the extra stop and whether it was a convenient way to swap the positions so the son of the team owner finished ahead. I must admit I was quite suspicious initially, but having had a listen through that stint, there was an amount of Nico sort of saying he reported that the vibration on this are quite high. He said it's much worse than the previous set. And then he reported a big blister on the rear left. And then, of course, he was called in to stop by the team and put onto softs. And they did offer him the chance to go for fastest lap. But obviously, I don't think the tyres quite had it in them to do that. So while I must admit I had some sympathy with the idea, it was very convenient. Everything they said and they did was consistent with what Hülkenberg said. He said on the slowdown lap, yeah, it's a shame about that set of tyres. He did ask about Lance's condition in at the start of his final stint and was told, yeah, it wasn't as bad there. So I don't know, maybe he just thought, well, that's okay, that's the way it goes. But it didn't affect the team's result in the end. And, you know, Stroll did a decent job in the race ultimately. Yeah, you have to give him some credit for that. Sixth and seventh Racing Point was a good good finish. Is anyone gonna sign up for the conspiracy theory on that? What do you think, Mark? Do you think it was a fair move?
No. I mean, occasionally there's something in them, but this one, no, I don't see it. I think Taylor always would want to be maximising. You know, they want to be close to the front as possible. So no, I really can't see it.
Yeah, and it's absolutely was consistent with the messages coming from Hülkenberg over the radio. And ultimately, if he has had his last drive for Racing Point this year, and they have said that they're not, Otmar Szafnauer, the team principal, said 99% sure that Perez will test negative. Got it right this time, Aaron. Last week I struggled with that. Will be cleared for Spain. I'd still say 99% sounds a little bit of a high certainty, but if not, Hülkenberg will be back in, and let's see what he can do. But he certainly reminded everyone he's a strong contender for a drive next year, and seems like Alfa Romeo and Haas, for example, and maybe a few others will have taken note. Now, Mark, before we get on to the minor points finishers, we should talk about Daniel Ricciardo's struggles. He ran sixth in the first stint. He qualified fifth, slipped behind Stroll the first lap. He had a spin just after his second stop that ultimately led to him finishing 14th after he had to sort of abort that stint and have another pit stop. He described that moment as a Seb spin, which I thought was a great description. I quite enjoyed that. It was an answer to my question. So why did he say that?
Well, I guess he's on the inside and trying to put the power down, which is the spin that Seb had when he was racing Daniel in Austin a couple of years ago. And Seb had a similar spin. It was a Bahrain when racing Lewis. It's when you're on the inside, wheel to wheel, but you're the guy on the inside, and you're having to put a bit more steering lock on than ideal in order just to avoid hitting the other guy. But you're trying to get out better traction out of there than him, and you just stand on the gas a bit too hard. And I think he was referring to he feels there might be some sort of aero effect. That you suddenly the car suddenly is robbed of downforce by the other car alongside it as you're in the transition of the turn, and he feels that happened at just the time that he had a lot of steering lock on and he was hard on the gas, and he's beginning to understand why Seb's had those spins now.
Yeah, he said he sort of bounded up to Seb in the media pen when they do the TV interview straight after the race to talk to him about it, because he said it's the first time he experienced it. So he probably went up to Seb and said, "Oh, I see what you mean. I just thought you were being rubbish, but actually, I get it now." I think that was the implication of what he said. But yeah, you know, the Renaults ultimately were quick. They struggled. They were a little bit on the back foot going into the race because they'd rather carelessly burned up one of their two sets of hard tyres on the Friday. They were the only team to do that. I asked Ricciardo about that after qualifying. He said, yeah, I only found out about that after. And then I asked a few questions because it was odd. I think 15 drivers in the race used two sets of hards in the race. So it was the main race tie. But obviously we saw Renault probably having the better of the battle with McLaren. That's kind of they're the natural enemies, both being Renault engine, upwardly mobile teams. Ocon came through to finish eighth on a one-stop strategy, but what do we make of the ebbs and flows between those two? Renault seem to be making some progress. Certainly, the past two weekends have been encouraging.
Yeah, I mean, Silverstone should have suited Renault more than it suits McLaren. I mean, McLaren tends to go better on type of tracks that require a bit of low-speed downforce, but they carry that comes with a bit of drag, and so circuits that are rewarding of low drag like Silverstone, you'd expect the Renault to do better. And it was a bit disappointing really on its in qualifying last week, but they seemed to have made some sense of it by race day, and they were flying towards the end of last week's race, both of them, and then that seemed to carry through in the qualifying for this one with Daniel in particular. But then yeah, you just they didn't hang the tire strategy together very well. They probably made the wrong choice with Daniel on strategy, and Esteban just salvaged what he could with a one stop. But yeah, very very strange why they used up that hard so early in the weekend when they only had two of them.
Feels like a little bit like that's what they normally do, therefore they did it, and then they thought, oh, hang on a minute. It's not like they wanted to use the soft. They didn't even use the softs in Q3. So, yeah, there was no benefit in saving them. But, yeah, the interesting little battle. And Scott, Carlos Sainz had a little bit of a handicap this weekend, didn't he, that was holding him back. So he was he ended up 13th in the race. So Norris again led the line for them.
Yeah, so on Friday, I think it was, McLaren noticed that there was a bit of an anomaly on Sainz's car. I think it was on one part of the cool on the cooling system, so it meant that from Friday onwards they noticed that his car was running slightly hotter than Lando's, and basically before qualifying they couldn't quite identify the cause of it, let alone obviously fix it. So their solution was effectively to open up the bodywork at the back of the car to prevent Sainz facing extreme temperature management in the race. So he wasn't held back in the Grand Prix because he was having to manage the problem. It was because of the workaround they'd basically come up with to avoid that, which meant that by opening up the bodywork, he had a bit more drag, which McLaren said accounted pretty much for the entire deficit to Norris in qualifying. I think it was less than 0.2, I think, like 0.18 or something like that. So it's not a huge amount, but obviously Silverstone's such a high-speed circuit, and it's not just like the hangar straight that's sensitive. You're pretty much flat now, aren't you, from what, like, as soon as you get on the power out of Luffield until you're braking for the set for Beckett's, halfway through Beckett's. So every time you're full throttle and at high speed, he was losing out a little bit. Not a huge amount, but it is something that he carried through qualifying and into the race. Still think he did a really good job, but unfortunately, McLaren clearly have an Achilles heel, don't they, in the pit stops. And Sainz appears to have completely deserted him so far this season.
Yeah, his first stop was very long. It was to do with the front left gun. There's an automated system that obviously clears when the wheels are all on and allows the green light to go. And the green light didn't go even though the wheel was on. So that cost him quite a significant amount. I think it's about 7 odd seconds that first pit stop was long. So that kind of knocked Sainz out of any contention for points. So that battle for the minor places ended up being kind of a fairly McLaren-y, Renault-y kind of affair with Ocon 8th, Norris 9th, and then in 10th place, we did have an interloper in Daniel Kvyat, the AlphaTauri driver who's ahead of Pierre Gasly. It's quite an interesting weekend for Kvyat because he was looking more promising in qualifying, and then he had the little mistake with a gust of wind in Beckett's, ran over the curb, had a big moment at Stowe, ran wide, and then had the lap time deleted, so fell in Q1, while Gasly was stunningly good in qualifying up in 7th place, continuing his pretty strong season. But then in the race, ended up with Kvyat 10th and Gasly 11th. It was slightly odd, Mark, though. Gasly ended up following Albon into the pits early on. That was perhaps a little bit of a misstep by AlphaTauri. It was a kind of very aggressive move from Red Bull, but it sort of set Gasly on a slightly tricky path, didn't it?
Yes. Gasly in the AlphaTauri wasn't ever going to be racing Albon over the distance. He was always going to be, you know, well behind. So why they place such importance on maintaining track position over him at that particular early stage of the race, I'm not quite sure, but that did compromise his race. It meant that he had to do too long on the subsequent stint, and that's really what cost him the position to his teammate.
Yeah, and Kvyat did a decent job in the race coming through from 16th, so solid for AlphaTauri, you'd say.
Yeah, and at least they had something to show for it, because as you say, Gasly's race unravelled. I was just going to say that if you were going to pick a driver to be interloping in 10th, it would be Kvyat, wouldn't it? He is just always going to show up somewhere between 9th and 12th. That just feels like a very Kvyat position. I sort of had this thought as a slightly flippant one, and then I just sort of dug up some stats just to see if I was completely making it up. But he has spent more laps, the most laps of his career have been spent in 9th, 10th, 11th or 12th position. It's actually 12th place is his most run position. He spent 552 laps of Grand Prix in 12th place.
Well, you could say that's about par for him then, because of course Vettel spun and then struggled, so finished behind him, and Ricciardo had the problem. So That explains that one, a par for Kvyat, but a decent performance. Yeah, so we had Kvyat 10th, Gasly 11th, Vettel 12th, Sainz down in 13th ahead of Ricciardo. Then we're kind of to the, for want of a better word, rather harshly, the dregs, I'm going to call them. Kimi Raikkonen in 15th place. He wasn't very happy after qualifying because the car's just not very good. He sort of said, well, 20th, 18th, 16th, what's the difference? He put it slightly more colourfully than that. Actually, Roman Grosjean in 16th place, his race obviously wasn't the most straightforward, but he was really good in qualifying. That was a really good qualifying lap from him. He rated that. He said it was like the Lotus days of old when he's running up front in races. And I think he put that in one of his three best Haas qualifying performances. So he was going well, but just as Kevin Magnussen, who had a penalty for rejoining dangerously while battling with Latifi, he was really struggling this time round. But the Haas drivers struggle to both do well at the same time. I think there's a bit of a driving style incompatibility there. And we had, obviously Giovinazzi 17th, Russell 18th, Latifi 19th. Latifi seemed a little bit unhappy that he wasn't ordered past Russell because he reckoned he was quicker. The Williams is obviously struggling a bit in the race this weekend, but Russell again stuck it in Q2, continued that run, which was encouraging for him. Has anyone got any strong feelings about that bottom six? Obviously, it's a very sort of clear battle with those three teams at the moment. Just the two Ferrari customers plus Williams.
Yeah, there doesn't seem to be a pattern really. It just seems to vary according to track sensitivities, track characteristics, and how they affect each car. What's quite tantalizing for Williams is that if they can sort of convert and get on a decent development curve and start regularly finishing ahead of those two teams, the back of the next group's not very far away. And you might be picking up the odd point here or there on merit rather than, retirements, which, after the couple of seasons they've just had, would be a massive result.
For Williams, the encouraging thing is that while there is clearly this step with the Mercedes engine this year, which I think is flattering them slightly in qualifying, it's certainly helping them more than, say, Haas and Alfa Romeo, who are their immediate rivals, but they just don't have any, they've got such blunted weapons over one lap. And then I think, because the Mercedes engine advantage isn't quite there to the same degree in the race, that plays a part in Williams slipping back. So it would be, I think it would be too easy a conclusion to say that the Mercedes engine is the only reason Williams seems to have made progress. Because if you put this year's Mercedes engine in last year's Williams was not becoming a Q2 marginal car, was it? That was just it just wasn't. So there is clear progress there, but yeah, as Mark says, there just needs to be that sort of concentrated effort to work out exactly what they need, because it's sort of, they're right on the cusp, aren't they? It's, if they make a step, then it'll be sort of a P11, P12, P13 car in qualifying, and then track position is absolutely crucial. And then who knows what you're racing for in that situation and if everything's going to fall your way.
Well, that's certainly what Williams will be gunning for. Some reason for optimism for them, at least, after this start to the season. Well, we're going to take a very brief break, and then we'll be back to talk about off-track goings-on. Well, we've talked about the on-track action, but this was one of those rare weekends when the stories off-track were grabbing pretty much all of the headlines, actually. There was no shortage of those on one of the busiest Fridays any of us could remember. Now, the trigger point for all of this was the verdict being released for Renault's protest against Racing Point's brake ducts. This all started almost a month before with the first protest after the Styrian Grand Prix. The upshot of it was that the front brake ducts of the Racing Point were legally designed, the rear brake ducts were illegally designed, but the parts themselves are not illegal. Now, Racing Point has been given a €400,000 fine and a 15-point deduction, as well as various reprimands, and it can continue to run the offending parts. Unravel that one for us, Mark.
Sporting and technical regulations, and they've tripped themselves over on the sporting regs with regard to the rear brake ducts. The technical regs, they're clean on. So it's an unsatisfactory situation, and I think the FIA, in realizing that it probably inadvertently contributed towards this problem by the lack of clarity in the regulations, has tried to, I think, give a fairly lenient sentence. It's accepted Renault's point in the protest and said, yeah, that is a valid point. So it's obliged to do something, but I think it's, in trying to give a lenient sentence, it's enraged a lot of the other teams who are not particularly upset with the brake ducts per se. It's the whole principle of how closely copied the Racing Point is of last year's Mercedes, which obviously opens the back door to customer cars, and that poses an existential threat to teams such as Renault, McLaren, Williams, because if there are a lot of Mercedes clones, obviously it's going to be extremely difficult to be competitive, because those clones would just be taking advantage of all the talent and investment that created the original car. And it's not a direction the FIA wants to go. It's subsequently made it very clear that it's not a direction that it wants F1 to go, and that it's going to revise the regulations to ensure it doesn't happen thereafter. But in the meantime, Racing Point has really taken advantage of a loophole, really, but in a way that has greatly upset the other teams. And there's a level of distrust because of the anger, mainly, at how it has been created. And passions and tempers are a bit inflamed at the moment, and that's, I'm sure, played its part in the fact that five teams have lodged a notice to intention to appeal the result. Four of them insisting that the penalties are not harsh enough, and the other one, Racing Point itself, insisting that it's been unfairly treated.
Yeah, it's been a great pile on, hasn't it, with other teams getting involved, not just those who are involved in the original one. But Scott, I mean, there's lots of different threads we can pull out here. Let's get the FIA stewards' verdicts itself out of the way. So in terms of what Racing Point actually did in designing their rear brake ducts illegally but front brake ducts legally, why is there this distinction, given that they are both effectively Mercedes designs?
Fundamentally, the key to this is the transition of brake ducts from non-listed parts to listed parts. Last year, it was perfectly legal for Racing Point to acquire the brake ducts from Mercedes, and that's what they did. They had the front brake ducts and the rear brake ducts. The key distinction is that the front brake ducts were incorporated into the RP19, the 2019 Racing Point, and the team developed it from there. And so the stewards ruled that the front brake ducts had been incorporated into the DNA of the car, and said, had Racing Point requested clarification from the FIA as to what they should do with those front brake ducts, considering their starting point was Mercedes data, and then in 2020 the brake ducts had to be designed by Racing Point themselves, would that be okay? The FIA wouldn't have turned around and said, no, you have to start all over again because this isn't your information. It was because they'd used that on their car and evolved it. The key difference is that they never used the rear brake ducts. So Racing Point may well have or claim legitimate reasons for doing this, because it didn't work with the aerodynamic principles they were aiming for at the back end of the car and the philosophy that they had with the RP19. But fundamentally, what it means is that the FIA believe that they bought the rear brake ducts with the sole intention of using those rear brake ducts to design 2020 components, because Racing Point suddenly had to design their own rear brake ducts, and therefore they can't be considered even like a Racing Point, like a hybrid of the Mercedes and Racing Point designs, because they were never on a Racing Point car. So they are just Mercedes rear brake ducts, and that's the key distinction. They had a hand effectively in the development of the 2019 design that became the 2020 front brake ducts, but to all intents and purposes, I think they even said that there's very little, almost indistinguishable, the rear brake ducts of the 2020 Racing Point and the 2019 Mercedes. So that's ultimately the key area that they fell foul.
But one person, Scott, who's definitely very irate about this verdict was Lawrence Stroll, the team owner, who made a very, very unusual public statement before the race on Sunday.
Are you calling it unusual because Lawrence doesn't normally speak, or because of the manner in which he delivered it through a bizarre auto-cue Sky Sports F1 interview / a written statement version of that speech released to the media?
Hostage video style, that's how I saw it.
It really was, wasn't it? It was unusual in any way you would wish to characterise what Lawrence Stroll did. It would fit any definition of unusual. He is... I have to be careful with what I say because I don't like some of what he has said. He's basically really angry. He doesn't like the fact that the team's been accused of cheating because obviously they've been found to have broken the rules. So he's really annoyed that because they've been found to have broken the rules, people are saying they've broken the rules. But I think it's more these little digs that Ferrari and McLaren are now dropping, which is that, oh, well, if it was the brake ducts that they had, maybe there was something sort of more at play. So he's basically, he's taken it as a personal insult. You can see that because he said, I think he said, I'll read out. I have never cheated at anything in my life. These accusations are completely unacceptable and not true. My integrity and that of my team are beyond question. Well, first thing I'd say to that is that nobody's integrity is beyond question. That's the whole point of a checks and balance process. But second of all, you can see that he has clearly taken this very personally. He's very angry at what he considers to be poor sportsmanship from Renault, Ferrari, McLaren and Williams, the teams that have all appealed the verdict. And he says that they're dragging our name through the mud. He's basically going to use every possible means that he's got. And let's not forget, this is a man of quite considerable means to basically exonerate the team, and I guess by extension himself, because as I said, he's conflating Racing Point with himself in this regard. He's also taken aim at the FIA for the vagueness of the regulations, and they've got a real bee in their bonnet about the fact that the front brake ducts were grandfathered but the rear brake ducts weren't. So he's saying, oh, this grandfather thing never existed, oh, I can't believe people are doing this. He's basically fuming, and to an extent, there's an element of it where you sort of say, yeah, I can understand it. But there is also a massive element of, I think this is because you're not used to getting your own way. And you're very, very irate about the fact that something so high profile has gone against you. And he's really, really had his nose put out of joint by the fact that other teams have jumped on the back of that and started to sort of prod a little bit further and harder.
I thought it was a little bit over the top, given that I thought the stewards did a fairly fair verdict, considering they accepted the fact that there was mitigation in the fact there was the gap in the rules. So, yeah, I thought it was a bit strange he attacked them. I think actually the stewards, and obviously I've gone through the verdict in painstaking detail. There's a piece on the race website. I'm just trying to headline the key distinction that proved Racing Point's downfall that tries to kind of explain the whole thought process of it. You've explained it quite well there, Scott, probably better than I did in writing, actually. So you maybe didn't even need to read it. But anyway, I think the stewards' verdict was probably a valiant attempt to make the most of a tricky situation, as Mark mentioned. There's this whole problem of the origin of the problem was the regulations didn't cover this eventuality. And that inevitably means there is mitigations. It was listed as one of the mitigating factors, along with the fact that Racing Point genuinely believed that they were doing the right thing and there was no problem with it. But there's a lot of kind of retrospective reasoning, and this would have happened had we been asked, etc. So it's very, very complicated. And there's also, Mark, the interesting fact that Mercedes does kind of have, well, it doesn't kind of, it very much has a part in this, because Appendix 6 of the sporting regulations, which covers the listed parts, states that not only can you not receive either parts or design information about listed parts, you also cannot provide it to a competitor. And Mercedes provided the brake ducts on or around the 6th of January this year, which is obviously in 2020. So Mercedes is implicated in this, isn't it? It was not considered a significant breach, but it was a breach nonetheless, according to the verdict. So how worried should Mercedes be about getting sucked into this more than they already are?
Yes, I think they should be concerned, especially as Ferrari is one of the people that have given notice of intent to appeal. And it'll be interesting to see what the each of those appeal cases concentrate on. And I wouldn't be surprised if Ferrari's addresses that very point.
Yeah, well, you will look at who you can get your hooks into as the basis of a appeal. And yeah, it's interesting for Mercedes, because Toto Wolff's been hitting out at the decision a little bit. He said that they provided the brake ducts to help out Racing Point with testing, basically. But it is pretty explicitly against the rules. But the steward did say it didn't give them any new design information. They already had all of the CAD models for those parts. So that's why it wasn't really considered to be a Mercedes problem. But there's so many examples of fallout from this. Now, Scott, we should talk about what Nicolas Tombassis, the FIA head of single-seater technical matters, said, because he said that there is a desire to reframe the rules so that copycat cars can't happen. Now, this is going kind of beyond the brake duct case, but also getting into the idea of a team copying another car. So what exactly has been said and what's going to happen?
Yeah, so as Mark mentioned a little bit earlier on, there has been this sort of indication from the FIA that they want to change the rules. What the FIA haven't done, what Tom Bass's didn't do, is outlined exactly how they intend to do that. They said that it's something that they want to roll out quite quickly, and basically they want to find a way to enshrine it in the rules so that wholesale copying of a car for an entire concept isn't possible. Now, this is F1. The devil is in the detail. I'm really struggling to work out how you assign something approaching a binary value to what copying an entire car concept is, because that is ultimately what it will come down to in the rules, isn't it? You're trying to put it in black and white and in clear terms what counts as whole car copying. I asked McLaren's technical director, James Key, this on Saturday evening, and he said that is exactly the point. The devil is in the detail. So they're going to be looking really, really, you know, with great interest as to what happens now. I suspect, and we talked about this sort of between ourselves, didn't we, Ed, exactly how you're going to use this, and maybe some of the teams will leverage this, use this as leverage to try and get a quick and expedited clarification within the regulations. You know, they've served their notice of the, you know, intention to appeal. So are they going to basically put pressure on the FIA now to say, we're going to kick up a massive fuss over this, but we'll let it go if you pledge that within 7 days or whatever? Or I don't know. I'm completely making this up in terms of like when they could do it, but just sort of that's what I would be doing in their situation, because the biggest victory they can get on top of this sort of vague pledge is obviously the details that will underpin it all.
Yeah, it's extremely difficult to work out how you can frame that rule. In fact, the steward's verdict in the case broadly seemed to accept the fact that the IP law, intellectual property law, can't be the standard against which your own design is defined. So that takes potentially one possible definition off the table. And in fact, that would probably be too rigid a definition for F1 to use. But what do you think, Mark? Is there a way to stop this copycat?
I don't think there's a way you can do it, as Scott is saying, in binary terms, and in terms of words. I think it may have to be something like the FIA has the right to scan every car and make scan comparisons between cars. And if it, you know, judges that one car is too close to another, then it's invalid. And maybe there's got to be some sort of homologation pre-season to determine this. And just like you have to get it through a crash test, you would also have to get it through a scan test to check that there's no similarity.
That's the big problem, though, isn't it? Because obviously there will be teams that have got alliances with other teams. You know, if you use a gearbox supply and an engine supply, that's going to define your risk. So there's common factors. Add to that the fact the 22 regulations are more constrictive and restrictive than ever before. So it's still going to be hard to work out what your percentage level is. So is it going to be one of these ones that's going to need the FIA to interpret it? It's kind of a, look, can everyone just be sensible and not take the mickey on this and go too far? Is it going to have to be one of those sorts of things where they've just got the unilateral power just to slap people down if they go too far?
Yeah, I don't think you can get a general consensus and a general agreement, a gentleman's agreement, because they always break down. I think it's going to have to be a case of effectively a referee saying, no, I'm not happy with that. We would maybe get Gary Anderson a job, because I think he'd be great at it.
I liked Mark's idea of, could you have it so at the beginning of the season, you're basically scanning the cars and making sure they don't cross over. It's reminding me of when I had to submit my dissertation at university, and it puts it through, there's like a software program that the university employs, and it runs your dissertation through it and works out, basically it applies a percentage of plagiarism onto the piece. So it basically scans it through, I guess, various articles and documents that it has within the system, and then it gives you a percentage. And if a certain percentage of the words and the structures of the sentences is too high, it considers it plagiarism, and you can't submit your dissertation. And that sounds to me like an absolutely bonkers, but brilliant. If there is a way to apply that to a Formula One car, what a system that would be.
I now want to know what percentage your dissertation came out as.
I think it was in sort of in the 30s. Let's say it was 35% plagiarized, which I think would explain why my final mark was 35%.
I like that, 35% plagiarized. I think we should do a range of T-shirts that say 35% plagiarised. I quite like that. But there's an idea for F1, but there's so many implications, and this one will probably run and run. But there was a lot of fractiousness in the paddock as well, wasn't there, Mark? We had Toto Wolff kicking off. Zak Brown in the press conference was getting a little bit punchy about the whole rest of the Racing Points car, implying that this verdict raised questions about the rest of the car, which I should add, the verdict says nothing about the rest of the car other than that agreeing with the principle of being able to photograph it and reverse engineer from that. They say that that's fine. So when it comes to this, why is everyone getting quite so frustrated? And what are the other factors? Is the whole Concorde thing starting to play into this as well?
Everyone's getting so upset because, as I said earlier, it is potentially an existential threat to about half the grid, who would quickly find themselves tumbled down the order and one by one probably potentially cease to exist because they would be out of the prize money over the years. So that's why it tempers are flaring, because it's if you accept the principle of what Racing Point has done, quite legitimately, because of the lack of clarity in the regulations concerning this particular point, then you are effectively changing the entire model of Formula One. And yes, the commercial agreement would very much be part of that. And that's only days away from the deadline to being signed. And if you're saying that actually by some circuitous route you can actually create a customer car, then your whole basis of your commercial agreement collapses, because those teams won't have the R&D costs and of creating a car themselves anymore.
It says a lot about how sensitive the subject is, that the likes of Racing Point, with the punishment that they have been found guilty, and I know they want to clear their name and everything, but they've been found guilty of something. They've got a competitive advantage that they will carry for the entirety of the season. They didn't just get a head start that saved them a week or so's worth of development. They've got something on the car that improves its performance. They've got that for the whole year, and they've dropped one decent weekend's worth of points, and they've been fined an amount that is, what, probably not even 10% of the amount they'll probably gain by having a much higher position in the Constructors' Championship because of the concept that they've introduced. And the brake ducts are not the reason that Racing Point will finish third or fourth or wherever in the Constructors' Championship this year, but it is all part of a wider concept, and every part plays its part. So Racing Point, really, having been found guilty, should have taken this on the chin, kept quiet, and gone, oh, do you know what? The stewards have sort of said, you've been a bit unlucky because the rules were a bit unclear, but ultimately, should have checked. Here you go. It's little more than an expensive slap on the wrist, basically. I think they should have just kept their mouths shut, basically, and let it just sort of go under the carpet a bit, because there is this wider issue about whether or not Racing Point and Mercedes have now... Is it just the brake ducts that they've traded? That is what McLaren and Ferrari are now asking. And basically, by rising to that, Racing Point's just going to bring more attention on itself. I'm pretty confident that the way that Racing Point and Mercedes have responded over the course of this weekend has now led several of those teams, McLaren and Ferrari, for example, they will now think that their suspicions have been proven correct because these two teams have now reacted jumpily. So they'll now be going after the FIA saying, hey, why don't you look into this a little bit more? One of the reasons that Toto Wolff, rather, on a personal level as well as in his role as team principal, has got so irate and so involved is because, as you say, everything's so hypersensitive at the moment. We've had Toto's clearly on edge over Concorde. He's always got daggers for Mattia Binotto at the moment. So anytime Ferrari pipes up, it lights a fire under Toto. We've talked about this before. So everything's super sensitive. So just in the moment where the parties involved should probably just play it cool, try and move past it, take this on the chin, accept that they've not done anything massively wrong, or go but or you know and stick to that story. they've got lots of other factors going on in the background, just little digs here, little digs here, and they just can't help themselves, which is why this is what should be, in theory, an isolated protest has now escalated into a full-on F1 civil war, hasn't it? We've got loads of teams at each other's throats.
Yeah, I think if you'd... I think Racing Point maybe would have just left it if they thought that no one else was going to appeal the outcome. But as soon as they heard that there was going to be appeals, I think they probably felt, well, to not put our own appeal in makes us look guilty. So, you know, that, as you say, it's touching a nerve with everyone. And I think really, yeah, it's unfortunate the way it's impacted on teams that are going to be disadvantaged this season and potentially next. But I think looking at the bigger picture, because it's been partly created by the FIA and the way the regulations have been written, I think really it would serve the sport and everybody involved in it well, if there could be some sort of behind-the-scenes diplomatic solution, maybe Ross Brawn getting everyone together and saying, look, this is the absolute worst time to be plunging ourselves into a civil war. We really need that spirit that we had before the season when the pandemic hit to get the whole sport through this. And I think that... Yeah, there's five teams have given notice of their intention to appeal, but they don't have to actually put those appeals in until Monday night, I believe. So in between times, in between now and that, I think it's quite important that there's some diplomatic knocking of heads together behind the scenes.
Yeah, that's certainly going to be happening. There's a lot of people will try and take advantage of this situation for their own gains. It's amazing, isn't it? Remember, though, we do remember those halcyon days during the lockdown when everything in F1 was happy and F1 had been saved, and wasn't it been brilliant? It's taken, what, five race weekends for everything to really fall apart. And this is in a socially distanced paddock where people aren't necessarily meant to cross bubbles and interact with each other. So imagine what it would be like if there was full freedom of movement around the paddock. It's been quite a...
It might actually be better. It's, you know, how people are rude on social media and say things to you on social media they wouldn't dream of saying to your face. It might be like that.
That's probably true, actually. Yeah, the isolation makes it harder. I suppose perhaps it's harder to get a little bit of an agreement, isn't it? You can... That's why they probably do all need to get together and work it out. But the clock's massively ticking. There's some very, very, very big things at stake. And trying to get it sorted on that timescale is tricky, but this has been coming from the moment that Racing Point first appeared and earned the pink Mercedes name. It's been clear, you know, I said this started just under a month before and at the start of this segment, but, you know, really it started in February when that car first appeared. So, yeah, there'll be some more arguments and some more horse trading to come. And, of course, you can follow all of that and even some of the on-track stuff on the race's website. That's therace.com. And don't forget the hyphen. Plenty of stuff from myself, Mark, and from Scott Mitchell, and of course, Gary Anderson, and all the rest of our crew. We've got loads of Formula E coverage going on at the moment, for example, with their Berlin Tempelhof Marathon 6-race season finale. So plenty to read on there. Do subscribe to the podcast, and maybe if you've got time, give us a bit of a review if you like what you hear. You can give us a review if you don't like what you hear as well, but I won't try and persuade you too hard to do that. But yeah. Otherwise, just thanks for listening. We've, of course, got another race coming up at the weekend, the Spanish Grand Prix in Barcelona. So I'm sure there'll be plenty more to talk about after that race in a week's time.